The headlines, Iran's president says his country will hold talks with the U.S. within the framework of the 2015 nuclear deal once Washington ends its economic terrorism on Tehran. Fresh officials called for partial weekend lockdowns and a ban on public gatherings amid a surge in the number of people treated in intensive care units for COVID-19. And Myanmar once again becomes the scene of protests against a military coup that ousted the country's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. It's our top story. Iran's president says that Tehran will sit down for talks within the framework of the 2015 nuclear deal only if the new U.S. administration lifts the economic sanctions imposed by its predecessor.
The new U.S. administration should immediately stop economic terrorism operations against Iran. Such a move will open the way. That's the key to opening the door and holding talks together. We have no problems with that.
Rouhani added, President Joe Biden's administration has acknowledged that the anti-Iran maximum pressure campaign by Donald Trump has failed. So Rouhani added, the new U.S. government should abandon that policy. He then underlined it was Iran that preserved the nuclear deal despite scaling down its commitments in response to Washington's 2018 illegal withdrawal from the accord. The Iranian president says his country has been the only signatory to the deal to fully deliver on all of its commitments. He called on the Europeans and the U.S. to make good on their commitments, too. The three European signatories to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal have called on Tehran to cooperate with the International Atomic Energy Agency. In a joint statement, foreign ministers of Britain, France, and Germany expressed regret about Iran's decision to suspend the additional protocol to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. In the meantime, the U.S. State Department spokesman called on Iran to work with the U.N. nuclear body. The comments come despite a deal reached between Tehran and the IAEA, which temporarily extends inspections of Iran's nuclear sites for 3 months. Iran's parliament passed a law last December which required the government to take further steps to scale back Iran's commitments under the JCPOA, including halting the voluntary implementation of the additional protocol. The parliament's decision was in response to the remaining signatories' failure to keep their end of the bargain. Political commentator Alexander Azadegan says the measures the West is taking against Iran prove its intolerance towards any revisionist power.
In my assessment, it's very hypocritical for the E3 to point the finger at Iran while after JCPOA was signed, literally a few months after it, President Rouhani went to Italy and to France. And they signed very lucrative deals with those countries that were in tens of billions of dollars. Of course, the Europeans reneged on all those because their excuse is very intricate and complicated rules and procedures that are dictated to European countries and, in fact, all countries and companies when it comes to the U.S. Treasury Department regulations and punitive measures to make sure no country or company does business with Iran. So we are at a conundrum. I think ultimately what they want to do to Iran, in my opinion, is what they did to Libya. Libya practically gave everything up, and Libya actually had a nuclear weapon program, which Iran is being accused of. You know, here was a first-rate Arab nation, and now it's controlled practically by gangs and Al-Qaeda and ISIS from different parts of Libya. I think the Western World Order or the Transatlantic Alliance doesn't want any challenges. They are not going to stand up to any revisionist or non-conformist powers. In this case, Iran. We're also looking at Russia and to some extent China, North Korea, Venezuela, and Syria.
Officials in France have called for a ban on public gatherings and partial weekend lockdowns as the number of the country's COVID-19 intensive care patients rose to a 12-week high of over 3,400. Regional authorities called for the restrictions as Paris continues to resist a new national lockdown to control more contagious variants of the coronavirus. The country has recorded over 20,000 new infections and 431 deaths. The figures raise the total cases to more than 3.6 million and the death toll to over 85,000. Elsewhere in Europe, German Chancellor Angela Merkel said her country is now in a third wave of the coronavirus pandemic. Merkel also noted that the slow vaccination rollout and the risk of major outbreaks of fast-spreading variants have made an easing of restrictions introduced late last year more difficult. Mexico and Argentina urged the United Nations and the world's richest countries to provide the poorer ones with better access to COVID-19 vaccines. In a joint press conference, Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador said the UN's scheme to ensure the poorest could get vaccines is not working. He said it's totally unfair that 80% of vaccine supplies are concentrated in 10 countries. His visiting counterpart, Alberto Fernandez, noted that he and his French counterpart are pressing the G20 to declare vaccines global goods. Inequalities in vaccine rollouts have sparked criticism, with the World Health Organization accusing wealthy countries of hoarding vaccine supplies. Now, Afghanistan has started its first COVID-19 vaccinations, administering doses first to security forces, health workers, and journalists. The campaign comes amid a sharp rise in violence in the war-torn country. Amiel Emi reports.
Almost 1 year after the first positive case of COVID-19 was confirmed in Afghanistan, the country has now launched its first COVID-19 vaccination campaign. Representatives of medics, Afghan armed troops, and journalists are the first ones who will receive doses of AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine, donated earlier this month by India.
Today I congratulate the people of Afghanistan on the launch of the first stage of COVID-19 vaccination. This is a big opportunity for the people of Afghanistan. I request all government bodies, media, and our religious scholars to cooperate with each other to implement COVID-19 vaccination campaign smoothly.
Afghanistan received 500,000 doses of AstraZeneca's vaccine from the Serum Institute of India, which is producing the vaccine for mid- and low-income countries, earlier this month. The spread of COVID-19 in Afghanistan hardly hit the Afghan society due to mismanagement and lack of medical equipment. However, officials here say the government is committed to implement COVID-19 vaccination campaign all over the country.
We don't expect any miracles. We need full collaboration of the entire society. So let's help this campaign to be implemented justly.
Taliban has announced its backing for the vaccination campaign. However, the inoculations comes amid relentless violence despite intra-Afghan talks. As official statistics estimate, up to 10 million Afghans, that make nearly a third of the population, might have been infected with the coronavirus. Nearly 60,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 and over 2,000 deaths have been recorded so far. Afghan officials say the pandemic is still a serious problem for the country and urge health workers to vaccinate the whole nation in a fair and transparent manner. Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Protesters have once again taken to the streets in Myanmar to denounce a military coup that ousted the country's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi. Hundreds gathered in Mandalay and the largest city, Yangon, chanting slogans against the military. The protesters have continued unabated for more than 2 weeks now in defiance of enhanced security measures by the military. A civil disobedience campaign has continued, too. People want civilian leaders to be reinstated and detained officials to be released. Myanmar's army seized power on February the 1st. It alleged fraud in November elections in which Suu Kyi's party won against a pro-military party. So far, three protesters have been killed and hundreds have been arrested. Joining us now from Frankfurt, we have coordinator of Free Rohingya Coalition, Mr. Nai San Luen. Sir, welcome to the program. Give us your perspective on the political turbulence that Myanmar is going through right now.
Well, you all know that the military took over the power since February 1st. So in the beginning, the people stay inside the house for 3 days. After 3 days, they start all the protests. And now the protests are increasing day by day. And across the country, millions of people are taken to the street, and they are protesting against this military coup. They don't want that this military dictatorship at all. They all are planning to release all the political prisoners, including this Aung San Suu Kyi and the President Win Yee, and also most of them agreed to demand to abolish the 2008 constitution, which was created by this military regime in 2008. Now the trend is they are targeting to abolish this constitution, which will enable the equal rights, justice for all, because this constitution is controlled by the military, and they are sharing the 25% seat at the parliament, and also the some ministry. The minister needs to be appointed by the commander in chief, and they are from the military. So I think the movement they call the Myanmar Early Spring Revolution. This will be, if they go continuously like now, I think the military will not last this time.
So what's the next step, in your opinion? What's the next step forward? Do things have to change internally, or is it, are we going to have to see more pressure from the outside, i.e. the international community with the United Nations at its helm?
Yeah, the United Nations, in the beginning, the UN Security Council released a statement, but they didn't use the term coup. So they don't really recognize this as a coup. And the U.S. imposed the sanction. Canada also imposed the sanction. The U.K. also imposed the sanction. And EU is considering for the sanction. And they have stopped all the support to the government. But still, the ASEAN is problematic. Now the foreign minister appointed by the military junta is today visiting Thailand. He is going to meet with the Thai counterpart, and also with the Indonesian foreign minister. Earlier she was planning to visit Nepal tomorrow, but today we had the trip has been canceled, and she is going to meet her there. So now it is meeting with the junta. Foreign minister is recognizing the junta. So the whole the entire country is really angry with the Indonesia for meeting with this junta foreign minister. So we need a lot of the pressure from the international community. They must not recognize this the military regime, and they should ignore and pressure the regime to hand over the power to the civilian government elected by the majority of the people. I'm not saying this election was the free and fair. It was credible election, because I don't recognize it as the free and fair, because the Rohingya were disenfranchised, and also in some many towns, there was no election due to the they said this is for the security reason. And also the same military, killed Rohingya in 2017. They are now killing the civilian, or protesting against the military regime. So it is very important to designate this military a coup leader, terrorist, because they are terrorizing the innocent and armed civilian across the country.
All right, thanks a lot, Mr. Nay San Luen, joining us from Frankfurt. Elsewhere, U.S. President Joe Biden is expected to call Saudi Arabia's King Salman as an American intelligence report on the murder of prominent journalist Jamal Khashoggi is about to come out. The Wednesday call would be the first talk between Biden as U.S. president and King Salman. The U.S. media outlet says Khashoggi's case would be a hot topic of their conversation. According to Axios, the report by the U.S. Director of National Intelligence could put one of the king's sons in a difficult situation. The unclassified document reportedly implies that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was involved in Khashoggi's murder. Khashoggi was a Washington Post columnist and strong critic of Saudi government policies. He was assassinated by Saudi agents at the country's consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. And authorities in the U.S. state of Texas say around 3.4 people still face disrupted water supplies following a deadly winter storm last week. The authorities said over 200 counties were reporting water issues as of Tuesday evening. The number was much lower compared on Monday. when over 7.9 million people faced water disruptions. The freezing weather conditions left dozens dead and knocked out power stations in Texas. It took several days for the authorities to restore power. Fresh water and food have been distributed to residents, with long queues formed in some locations to receive these supplies. Clashes have erupted in the Bolivian capital, La Paz, between police and medics during a protest against a new health emergency law. Riot police fired tear gas to scatter protesters who demanded the repeal of the controversial legislation. Health workers have been on strike across Bolivia since Friday to show their opposition. The law bans medical staff from taking job action during the coronavirus pandemic. It also allows the hiring of foreign doctors and nurses. The protesters say the move is unconstitutional and restricts the right to protest. The COVID-19 outbreak has pushed many hospitals in Bolivia to the brink of collapse. The Andean country has so far reported nearly 250,000 infections and more than 11,000 deaths. Crowds of Ecuadorian indigenous people have arrived in the capital, Quito, to protest an alleged electoral fraud. Protesters demanded a recount of this month's presidential election. Left-wing indigenous leader Yaku Perez addressed them. He said of the nearly 40,000 voting sheets, almost half have inconsistencies. Perez said that has denied him a place in the runoff. Ecuador's Elections Council this week confirmed that left-wing economist Andres Arauz and conservative banker Guillermo Lasso will advance to the runoff. The vote is slated for April 11th. President of Venezuela Nicolas Maduro has accused the U.S. and its allies of deepening the economic crisis in the South American country by imposing illegal sanctions. Legal experts say such sanctions amount to crime against innocent people. From Caracas, Jesus Silva has more in this report.
Delivering a speech at the 46th session of the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, Venezuela's president, Nicolas Maduro, denounced the damaging effects of ongoing illegal sanctions by the U.S. and its allies against the Bolivarian Republic. Maduro outlined that Washington, following its regime change policy, leads a coalition of states that the European Union is part of, which is implementing a long series of punishing measures to deliberately bring about a humanitarian crisis in Venezuela and overthrow his administration. Maduro mentioned details of these measures.
Through illegal measures, Venezuela has been deprived of $30 billion in cash, which are part of the assets of the Republic abroad.
In this light, the socialist president strongly condemned the U.S. government and its allies over their abusive actions against the Venezuelan people.
Those who have taken away Venezuelan assets and resources have shown their cruelty, even worse at a time of a pandemic.
Although some opposition figures in Venezuela argue that the U.S. sanctions are a needed political tool to force anticipated elections in the Latin American country, legal analysts say that such sanctions are totally illegal and unacceptable.
What the U.S. is doing to our nation violates international law and all human rights instruments. There is no way to justify such a crime.
President Maduro denounced over 450 illegal sanctions U.S. and its allies imposed on Venezuela. Maduro pointed out that despite the massive economic aggression, his socialist government will not be overthrown. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Second phase of the revolution.
Of the revolution. Of the revolution.
Leap in production. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Steel and steel products, copper and copper concentrates, cement and clinker, lead and zinc, building decoration stones, tile and ceramics, are the minerals that Iran exports to neighboring countries, China and the countries of Southeast Asia. Iran's Mines and Mineral Industries Development and Renovation Organization, IMIDRO, in cooperation with the private sector, have planned to launch new development projects worth $2.3 billion in the current Iranian year. These projects will create 8,300 jobs directly and 64,000 jobs indirectly. Thus, over 70,000 jobs will be created in this area. IMIDRO has been formed with the aim of meeting the domestic needs to mineral products in a bid to optimize the country's economic system in the mineral sector and affiliated industries, and also supervise the usage of mineral reserves and their proper exploitation. Accordingly, implementation of projects for construction, development, equipment, and renovation of industries related to production, excavation and processing of minerals, and implementation of exploration works are among the long-term goals of this organization. Mineral activities and industries enjoy competitive privileges in underdeveloped regions. Some of these privileges include potentials for the growth of investment in chain units of mine sector and mineral industries with modern technologies and development of mineral activities and mineral industries abroad with the aim of integration of value chain in production sector. These form part of strategic activities to bolster mines and mineral industries. In view of this, like the past year, IMIDRO is implementing the project of revival of stagnant mines of private sector with a broader plan, which is an important step toward providing feed of production units and leap in production of mines and mineral industries. Last year, 146 mines were revived, part of which has entered the production sphere. It is estimated that with complete activation of these mines, 3,000 jobs will be created annually in this sector, and a notable part of the feed of processing factories will be secured from these mines. This year is also the year of yielding fruit of steel manufacturing of steel industries. Last year, Mubarakeh Steel Company and National Copper Industries Company managed to materialize the investment growth, and Gulguhar Company of Sirjan has also stepped in the same route. But due to the problems caused by coronavirus outbreak, investment growth has been postponed in Gulguhar. After these three companies, another huge company is in the route, namely Chador Malu in Yazd province. To this, we should add the project for production of 10 million tons of steel at the special Persian Gulf zone per year. Part of this project has been implemented, but the other part is going to be finalized with the participation of regional companies. Moreover, another project is underway in the southernmost region of the country, that is Chabahar. Once accomplished, this project will turn Makran coastlines into the hub of producing 10 million tons of steel per year. The mines and minerals have seen a two-digit growth in exports in the past year. Gigantic complex of Sangan, as the capital of Iran's iron ore, will host new factories for production of iron concentrate and iron ore. Sangan Mineral Company is going to produce 17.5 million tons of iron concentrate and 15 million tons of iron ore. Presently, Iran is one of the greatest producers of gas-based sponge iron and among the 10 producers of steel in the world. This comes while Iran has been put several times under the most brutal sanctions by the U.S. The upsurge in production, exports, explorations, and implementation of development projects promise a great leap in production in the mineral field of economy. As the mines and mineral industries are based on exploration, 400,000 kilometers have been added to the area of the related activities during the past 1.5 years. This has been unprecedented in Iran. These explorations have yielded in identification of 760 promising areas. Exploration of new mines in the country will definitely play a key role in leap in production. In spite of global sanctions orchestrated and spearheaded by the U.S., production and trade has been on the rise during the past 2 years of 1397 and 1398. However, according to the report of the Parliament's Special Commission for Support of National Production and Supervision of Implementation of Article 44 of the Constitution, the industry sector has not gained the position that it should. This comes while there are high capacities and potentials in the sector due to the high technical know-how and big number of graduates in production engineering. These potentials should be applied for boosting of production and leap in production.
Greetings and a warm welcome to another edition of the debate on Behrouz Najafi. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has stressed in his recent speech that the Islamic Republic is not seeking nukes, while at the same time it won't dispense with the nation's right to utilize peaceful nuclear energy. It also reminded the fact that Iran believes in the slogan, nuclear energy for all, nuclear bombs for no one. Ayatollah Khamenei says that Iran would have nuclear weapons today if it had wished to have them. He stressed that it's the Islamic ideology that bans all forms of mass destruction weapons. Now the question is, if the West is really concerned about Iran accessing nukes, why did they not stick to the 2015 nuclear deal? The U.S. even scrapped it altogether. Now we'll watch a report and then discuss the issue.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has slammed what he called the arrogant, high-handed, unjust, and erroneous rhetoric of the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal toward the Islamic Republic. Ayatollah Khamenei also denounced Britain, France, and Germany for failing to comply with their commitments under the nuclear agreement. The leader also lashed out at Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has repeatedly accused Iran of trying to acquire nuclear weapons. The leader added that Iran will never bow down to U.S. pressure and will not back down on its logical stance on its nuclear program. Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei referred to a law passed by the Iranian parliament in late December that requires the government to take additional action to reduce commitments to the nuclear deal, which includes a decision to end the voluntary implementation of additional protocol. The leader said Iran will develop its nuclear capabilities in line with the needs of the country, and for this reason, Iran's enrichment purity level will not be limited to 20%. He said Tehran may increase the level to 60% if it deems necessary.
We should remember that the framework about around this whole thing here is that a number of nuclear powers are sitting telling what Iran should do, which is not a nuclear power, while other nuclear powers are not even discussed.
Following the U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear agreement and its reimposition of sanctions in May 2018, Tehran exercised patience and remained fully committed to its obligations under the accord. However, a year later, Iran started to reduce its commitments in five gradual steps every 60 days, citing the failure of the European signatories to the JCPOA to uphold their end of the deal. In the meantime, Iran's ambassador to Vienna-based international organizations, Kazem Gharibabadi, said on Monday that Tehran has terminated the voluntary implementation of additional protocol, which allowed snap inspections of Iranian nuclear sites. On Sunday, Iran and the UN nuclear watchdog reached an agreement for the continued inspection of Iranian nuclear sites for 3 months. Gharibabadi said Iran would record information at certain nuclear facilities without the supervision of the inspectors as per the new agreement. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has recently expressed willingness to participate in an informal JCPOA meeting with Iran and other signatories. It has offered to hold talks with Iran over how to return to the deal. This is why Iranian officials have repeatedly and unequivocally rejected any preconditions or talks on the U.S. return to the deal, arguing that it was the U.S. that abandoned the accord and violated the U.N. Security Council 2231 that endorsed the multilateral agreement. Tehran says it will reverse its scalebacks to its commitments under the deal once all sanctions are lifted and all the signatories go back to full compliance.
Now, that was the report. Now, let me invite our guests to this debate show. We have Director of Risala, the Strategic Studies Institute, Sam Mehdi Torabi, joining us out of the Iranian city of Qom, and also a journalist and political commentator, Said Mohsen Abbas, out of London. Welcome to the show, both gentlemen. Let's go to Qom. Sam, world powers reached a nuclear deal with Iran after marathon negotiations, and then when it came to implementation, the U.S. left it altogether, while Iran remained in full compliance for more than a year, as you know. So in what context do you assess Washington's departure from what Europeans call a landmark accord?
Well, Berjan, we've talked about this many times before. There was an attempt over 30 years by elites in Iran to so-called normalize relations, normalize economic relations with the West. We even heard this in the interview that Dr. Zarif had with Press TV a couple days ago, that he mentioned three goals. Out of the JCPOA, he said, making the enrichment, Iranian enrichment official under international law, ending Iran's securitization, and the final goal was to normalize economic relations. Well, this is something that did not happen in reality, and it was never going to happen. The point is that there was a belief among Iranian elites, many of them, not all of them, that there could be something called normal economic relations between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the West, not understanding that the relations between Iran and the West over the last 200, 300 years have been predatory. So there's no such thing for the West as normal relations. So we've now come to this end of this process after 20, 30 years. We made our best effort. The whole world saw that Iran is willing to give up part of its strategic capabilities, in this case, as it relates to nuclear technology, for this thing that was called normal economic relations, which, again, as I mentioned, is something that was never really going to happen. And this process now has come to an end. It failed on the ground, and the Americans were never going to, whether it was Obama or Trump or Biden or whoever else might come in the future, were ever going to establish normal economic relations with Iran.
Okay, now let me turn to London. Said Mohsen Abbas, Tehran is saying that it could have nukes if it wanted to, as I mentioned in intro. But the thing is that even if we want to move in that direction, Islam won't allow it. So on what ground is the West crying wolf when it comes to Iran's nuclear activity?
It's crying wolf on the ground that they're under platforms, essentially, from forces behind the scenes. One of those forces is obviously Israel. The other one, arguably, is the moneylender mafia, which pretty much controls the economic and military and political game globally. The fact of the matter is that these guys, like Biden or Netanyahu, are ultimately puppets and levers of power, if you like. So, to be honest, these guys are the messengers. They deliver the message which the global powers that be want implemented. The problem for them is that the Islamic Republic of Iran is one of the only nations now left that isn't part of the Bank of International Settlements, not part of that, if you like, control mechanism that they want. It doesn't comply with the values and the ethics and the morality, whatever that is. I mean, in fact, it's a non-existent morality. And Ayatollah Khamenei re-emphasizing his religious commitment to not having nuclear weapons is significant for a Muslim or for somebody who understands morality. It has no significance for these folk because they don't have any intention of being truthful in any policy that they roll out. All of their policies are based on economic, if you like, priorities, which will always, always, always trump ethics and morality. So you're dealing with an essentially immoral beast, and Imam Khamenei knows this. Just give you an example. Earlier this month, French President Emmanuel Macron pitched himself as an honest broker between the Biden administration and Tehran. But he also insisted that the countries such as Israel and Saudi Arabia should be involved in talks. You know, as if Israel and Saudi Arabia are some sort of neutral party, and as if Israel isn't already violating the nuclear, if you like, situation globally. It's accountable to nobody. Over 400 nuclear weapons pointed probably mainly at Iran. And it's continuously causing trouble. Saudi Arabia is its kind of clandestine puppet as well. This is the problem. This is the insight which the assembly of experts today, who Imam Khamenei addressed, knows. They've managed to keep imperialism off the soil of Iran since the revolution. That is going to stick in the gullet of the powers that be, and they will not really abide by any agreement. You've seen it already collapse once. What's to say that when Biden goes out of power, even if he were to agree to something with Iran now, which is highly, highly unlikely, what's to say that they won't just renege on their deals? They're known for it. It's a common practice.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, Sam, Iran's nuclear activity has undergone the largest number of international inspections, multiple reports put forward by the IAEA, all confirming the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear activity. Tehran has not benefited from the nuclear deal, but still allows the IAEA inspections to go on, except for that voluntary part of the additional protocol. Isn't this indicative of Iran's goodwill?
Of course it is. And again, we have to remember a couple things here, Behrouz. One is that everything that Iran has been doing is completely legal under international law, is now, by the law that was passed by the Majlis, incumbent and obligatory on the executive branch to fulfill it. So as far as legally and morally, I think we don't need to keep repeating that Iran has the moral high ground, that Iran has the right. We need to get beyond this. This is a fact. It's established. Everybody knows it. The only problem is that countries like the European countries, which, you know, claim to be very civilized and sophisticated, but the reality is that they do not dare to speak against the country that won World War II and has been occupying them for 70 years. This is the reality of Europe. And I go back that all of this discussion goes back to an incorrect understanding among some Iranian elites of the realities that exist in the world. They thought that they could have a thing called normal relations with the West. This basically does not exist. There is no such thing as normal relations with Western powers. There's no such thing as normal relations with America. So there was an attempt by certain Iranian elites after the war, around the personality of the late Ayatollah Hashemi Rafsanjani, to get this thing going. They've been trying it for 20 years. Everybody, including the Supreme Leader, has said, fine, go do it, let's see what happens. It is now, we have now experienced this on the ground empirically, that it's not going to happen. And of course, the biggest problem with this understanding is that there might have been some way of justifying this understanding 30 years ago, 1990, 1989, 1991, mm-hmm. that there was only, you know, the West or America. But the world in 2020, 2021 is very different than 1990. There's a lot of other economic powers in the world which Iran can cooperate with. And the most important thing is that Iran itself has much more powerful and much more economically capable than it was 30 years ago. But unfortunately, these elites were able to have the policy decision-making in the country in a way control it or in a way influence it that allowed them greater power than the reality of what was on the ground. So now, all of this has happened. Iran has shown its good faith internationally. Right. Iran has allowed the democratic processes within Iran to take shape. Governments get elected, get mm-hmm. reelected. New governments come into play. The people decide what they want to do. And so, this process has now come to its natural end. It's very unlikely that this administration is going to end this process because this is all they had to offer in these 8 years when they came. So probably what will happen is that in the beginning of the summer, when we have a new administration in Iran, this process is going to end in a more official and in a more significant way than we see it today.
Okay. Now, Said Mohsen, the Islamic Republic regards use of weapons of mass destruction an unforgivable sin. So to that, it's even raised this initiative called the Middle East Free from Chemical Weapons. What Iran insists to continue is the peaceful use of nuclear energy. Every country is right. So what's wrong with that?
I think it's a fantastic initiative. And I think that this is where the Islamic Republic of Iran has to back from. They've got to stop, as my colleague was saying, stop looking to the West for frameworks, for solutions, for ideas, not be bedazzled by the technical advancement or the kind of military advancements they've had over the last century or two or longer, and actually start turning, as they are doing, internally to their own source of intellectual and creative, if you like, advancement. And I think that part of that, quality that the Iranians do have, it's something that they need to acknowledge to themselves, is that they have a moral infrastructure, a framework which can build these kinds of ideas, you know, give the world solutions to the problems which neo-capitalism, neoliberalism, hyper-capitalism of the West has gifted us with. Look, we're facing a world where an economic reset, a global economic reset, is being engineered by those very powers which have raped and pillaged not only the East, far more of the East and Africa and that part of the globe, but they've also been subjugating and, if you like, controlling the people in the West with all sorts of amazingly destructive notions, like, for instance, their ideas around, for instance, feminism. We could put other things on the table that are there in terms of gender fluidity, the whole moral morass which is picked up here. All of this has been gifted by the powers that be that are pushing out these ideologies. How long, if these elites, which my colleague talked about, do constantly look to the West for some sort of direction, as to where Iran should go, or in terms of following their lead on this JCPOA or following their lead on other matters. Well, to be honest with you, I think you're looking at a sort of an empire in recession, in collapse, and it really is a credit to Iran that even in this economic, if you like, terrorism phase that we've seen, especially over the last decade, rolled out against Iran, what's Iran done? There are more university students coming out of those universities, which wasn't existent under the Shah, for instance. There are more accelerations in aerospace technology. There's been an advancement in moving away from oil and reliance on gas only to actually using the resources of Iran on a wider field. This self-sustainability, this turning more to the east, if you're going to look for any backup, is the way forward. And I think that you can't teach an old dog new tricks. I'm afraid the Western system is fundamentally opposed not only to Iran, it's opposed to its Islamic revolutionary ideology. It's opposed to the morality that revolution potentially stands for, and it doesn't want any of that to be, if you like, filtered into the rest of the globe. So therefore, it's obliged to try and do everything it can to destroy Iran, trying to make a friend out of a wolf for any animal that actually is on its dinner menu is naive and foolish.
Right. Okay, Sam, the United States, as you know, possesses the largest arsenal of lethal and mass destruction weapons. It's even used them against other countries. So how can it expand its nuclear arsenal at the same time expect others to get rid of them?
Well, like I said, I mean, these discussions are, you know, something that are so basic and elementary, I don't think we need to waste our time on these issues. The reality is that it's not about international law. It's not about, you know, agreements and so on and so forth. I mean, yes, they have a certain place, maybe as a marginal issue. The whole UN system is a tool, as the Westerners see the UN system and the Americans see the UN system as a tool of, you know, expanding their own power and projecting their own power. So I think this is a problem that some of the people in Iran have, is that they actually believe the things that they read in the books in terms of international relations and international law. I mean, it's very different, the reality of what the world is, from what it is in the books. International law is a very narrow concept, and it is used and seen by Western powers as a tool of their own power. So there's no point in us trying to really, you know, look at this as a way of salvation or trying a way to figure out how the world we're going to govern that. I understand Dr. Zarif, as an international lawyer, making narrow arguments under international law. I understand that. Mm-hmm. This is something that, as an academic, I get it. But this is a very different issue than what the reality of the politics of the world is. Yes, it's true. According to the, you know, UN resolution, Iran now officially can enrich. But why do we even have to go there? Why did we even have to you know, go into that position where, you know, that we have to say that this is a victory? I believe that this is changing the goalposts after the fact.
Okay.
The goal of the JCPOA, as stated by the Supreme Leader, was getting rid of the sanctions on Iran. It has not happened, and it will never happen under the JCPOA.
Okay.
The whole point of the JCPOA was to create a framework for Iran and the West to talk so that the West could start talking about Iran's strategic military capabilities, such as missiles and nuclear energy and other things and whatever else it wants to add in the future.
Okay.
Well, we tried it. We showed good faith. We were even willing to compromise for a certain amount of time on our strategic capabilities. It did not happen. Let's move on.
Okay, good. Now, Zedmosin, one last question. We have very little time for that. Recently, we have had the satellite images showing even further activity at the Dimona nuclear facility used by the Tel Aviv regime. Who's posing a threat to regional peace?
Well, if you want to look at the Yinon plan, which Israel has been working on ever since the 60s and perhaps even before that, if you want to look at the number of U.S. bases that are dotted around all around the Middle East, and particularly now lining up all around the Islamic Republic of Iran, if you want to look at the interference in Syria and of British and American forces prior to the war that was initiated by themselves, If you want to look at ISIS and Daesh and the inability to finish them off completely, that's just the tip of the iceberg. If you want to look at Iraq and its kind of, if you like, total decimation and destruction, all roads lead to Tel Aviv and Washington, D.C. There are no other routes. The rest of them, the London, the German capitals, they are like tails of a dog, and they wag according to whatever the main beast wants. So
I've got to jump in. I'm sorry. That's all the time we have. Thank you very much for your comments. We had Director of the Risala Strategic Studies Institute, Sam Mehtotrabi from Qom, and journalist and political commentator, Saif Mohsen Abbas out of London. And thank you for watching this debate. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi. I'll see you next time.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of the life. Keys of life.
Akhil Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We're up to chapter 6, which is the chapter of the etiquette of eating and drinking. We know that the primary sustenance that we need to survive, to live as human beings, is food and drink, and without these two things we will not be able to continue on living. And so it's a necessary primary requirement for us. The way that Islam sees food and sees drink in both senses equally to be the ni'mas, among the blessings of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And therefore, there is a certain way that we need to handle the blessings of God. Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam, he says, "La tazalu hadhihi al-umma bi khair." This ummah will continuously be good, be well. Ma lam yalbasu libas al-ajam. As long as they do not wear the clothes, the attire of al-ajam. Al-ajam here is in reference to the foreigners. And the understanding, the correct understanding in this context is in reference to the non-Muslims. وَيَطْعَمُوا أَطْعِمَةَ الْعَجَمِ مَا لَمْ يَلْبَسُوا. So as long as you don't wear the attire of the non-Muslim, and as long as you don't eat from the food of the non-Muslim, وَلَمْ يَطْعَمُوا أَطْعِمَةَ الْعَجَمِ. فَإِنْ فَعَلُوا ذَلِكَ. And if they were to do so, if the ummah was to do so, if people in the ummah were to do so, ضَرَبَهُمَ اللَّهُ بِالذُّلِّ. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will strike them with humiliation. So they will feel humiliation. this is kind of like a warning sign for us to just to remember that always make sure that you are who you are, your person, your identity, how you dress, how you present yourself. And in this case, what it is that you eat. And in the Hadith al-Mi'raj, when Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi ascended up to the heavens, it is said, the Hadith says, Ya Ahmad, O Ahmad. And then a part of the Hadith says, فَإِذَا أُطِيبَ مَطْعَمُكَ وَمَشْرَبُكَ, if your food and your drink is tayyib, tayyib here in the sense means legitimate, means halal, فَأَنْتَ فِي حِفْظِي وَكَنَفِي, you are going to be in my protection, you are going to be in my shelter. Another hadith from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, مَنْ أَكَلَ الْحَلَالَ قَامَ عَلَى رَأْسِهِ, one who eats halal, قَامَ عَلَى رَأْسِهِ مَلَكٌ, an angel will stand over this person's head, يَسْتَغْفِرُ لَهُ حَتَّى يَفْرُغَ مِنْ أَكْلِهِ, that the angel will seek forgiveness for this person until this person finishes from their eating. So we all know how important it is for us to make, to remember that we are to eat halal food.
Ayatollah Javadi Amoli, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafati, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
And when we're talking about halal food, we're not only discussing the topic of it being slaughtered Islamically, it not being contaminated by any kind of najasa. We're talking about halal food in the sense of your income also being halal, your money that you have acquired is also halal, by which you are going to be buying food for your family and for yourself. So that's also to be taken into consideration. So what are the main etiquettes of eating? What are the main adab of eating in Islam? Number one, halal. Number two, that you wash your hands. You wash your hands before you eat. You wash your hands after you finish eating. It's also mustahab that when you have guests, for you to wash their hands as well. For you, the host, to wash their hands. And of course, we're also going to mention later on, it's mustahab for you to be in the state of wudu as well, for you to do wudu before you eat. Remember that the food is among the blessings of God, and we need to treat it as such, with sanctity, with honor, with respect. And in treating it as such, there are these things that all need to be taken into consideration. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he says, "Man ghasala yadahu qabla at-ta'am wa ba'dahu